It is Sunday, June 5th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. In the next half hour, as the world pays tribute to American boxing legend Muhammad Ali, we'll hear from an American author who befriended Ali years ago and maintained a close relationship. We'll tell you why the U.S. and China are facing pressure to give in to each other over the South China Sea dispute. And our Senate correspondent tells us what to expect from this week's final state primaries in the U.S. presidential race. It's all ahead on International Edition. For millions of people around the world, the death of boxing great Muhammad Ali closes a colorful, lively, and courageous chapter of collective memories. Davis Miller, author of Approaching Ali, recalls with VOA's Jim Stevenson a 30-year friendship with one of the world's biggest cultural icons and what Muhammad Ali meant to so many people.
He's in us as deeply as Martin Luther King or Jack Kennedy or the Beatles collectively. Maybe because his journey's gone on so long, maybe deeper than that. You know, I think what's going to happen when Ali passes is that the whole world's going to stop. I think it'll surprise people in the U.S., but that it's going to be bigger than Kennedy. The world is just going to stop for a few minutes or a few days. How can the world be without Muhammad Ali? Something about him, as ridiculous as he is this fantastic figure. Something about him in that ridiculousness is every bit as hopeful as the space program, traveling to the moon. It was in the 1960s and early 70s. Absolutely a fantastic human being.
Not too many people get the opportunity to meet their icon face-to-face, much less go up to the doorstep and knock on the door and introduce themselves. That's exactly what you did.
It is precisely what I did. And the part that's not in the book is that I found out that day I was losing my job clerking in video stores. And I was despondent. I had a mortgage, car payment, wife, two young kids, all that stuff, and didn't know what I was going to do. And then I drove past Ali's house on the way home to Louisville and knocked on the door, and it changed my life. The synchronicity of it just sounds silly. I mean, it sounds like a horrible movie premise. But it happened. Within days, I was a professional working writer. And the story I wrote about that first evening became famous, and David Halberstam judged it one of the 20 best pieces of sports writing of the 20th century, and the Washington National Opera commissioned a chamber opera from it. We're talking about a movie now, culminating in this book, and in this nearly 30-year friendship now. That kind of mess doesn't happen, but it has.
You have had the good fortune to meet with him and speak with him many times over the years, and we certainly remember him at the 1996 Atlanta Olympics lighting the flame, and probably an image that many people hold on to, watching him hold that flame, his arm shaking.
I think you're right. You know, the thing at the Olympics in 96, people tell me with some regularity, you know, I remember that the way I remember JFK being shot. It goes that deeply inside people that a lot of people probably hadn't seen him since the late 70s or early 80s and maybe didn't even know that he was quite ill. And then he stands there with that torch in his hands and that shaking right arm, and we see it as somehow tough, beautiful, sad, ennobling. And again, just another part of this guy's mythology that I don't think is pop mythology. I don't think it's not Michael Jackson or Madonna. It's going to hang around. One of the things he says regularly is, don't feel sorry for me. I've seen everything a man can see, done everything a man can do. I've had the life of 100 men. And it's extraordinary. He's an extraordinary man.
And that was author Davis Miller speaking with International Edition's Jim Stevenson about the life of Muhammad Ali, who died on Friday at age 74. Well, staying with our top story and International Edition's social media correspondent, G. Abby Lee, joins me in the studio with What's Trending Online. Hi, G.
Hi, Michael.
Well, we've seen a lot of condolences for Muhammad Ali this weekend, haven't we?
We did, and it looks like people are not going to stop talking about him anytime soon. On Twitter, hashtag Muhammad Ali is still trending, and his professional Facebook page is also getting a lot of attention. More than 11 million people liked his page, and the latest post on there reads like this. To express your condolences, share your stories, or give a donation for Muhammad Ali's legacy, please visit alicenter.org.
Well, tell us about some of the top comments for that Facebook post.
Sure. So the most liked comment received nearly 1,700 likes, and that's quite unusual for a Facebook comment. A user named Saeed left a quote by Muhammad Ali, and it's, "I asked Allah for wealth, he gave me Islam." Many of the comments contained similar hashtags, his name, of course, but also hashtag RIP champ and hashtag the greatest. I read through maybe a dozen of them, and a few dozen of them actually, and not gonna lie, it brought tears to my eyes. People share their favorite Ali quotes, but also their experiences with him. Some people got to shake his hand while waiting for an operation at a children's hospital as a kid, others before or after his fight. Out of the personal stories, my favorite is this, left by a comment to his daughter, Layla Ali's Facebook page, and it reads like this. "My parents divorced when I was approximately 11 years old. Shortly after I saw your dad fighting on TV, I thought we looked alike, so I adopted him as my dad." That's all for me today, Michael.
Just another sign of how much impact he had on so many people. Thank you, G. Well, you can tweet us with your questions and comments at VOA_IE. You can also tag me and G on the tweets. We are at Michael_Lippin and at G. Abby Lee. Well, here are some of the top stories trending now in Asia. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry warns China against establishing a South China Sea air defense zone. Philippine President-elect Duterte says he will pay citizens a bounty for killing drug dealers. Taliban Islamist militants open fire in an Afghan court in the eastern province of Logar, killing 7 people. And Muslims around the world prepare to observe the holy month of Ramadan, which begins on Monday. We've got expanded coverage of these stories and more on voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. And International Edition continues. Washington is preparing to discuss several contentious issues with Beijing at an annual dialogue that begins on Monday in the Chinese capital. One of those issues is U.S. concerns about Chinese behavior in the South China Sea, a key international trade route. China has been developing 7 artificial islands in the disputed waters in recent years, prompting the U.S. and its Asian allies to fear that Beijing will turn those islands and others into military bases. Philip Reynolds is a researcher on conflicts and a PhD candidate at the University of Hawaii. He says he does not believe the United States can reverse China's territorial gains in the South China Sea. In an interview with VOA, Reynolds also says Washington should focus instead on reaching an understanding with Beijing.
One of my fears is that if the U.S.-China confrontation in the South China Sea hardens due to U.S. domestic politics, that puts the United States in a very bad position. We already have the Cold War legacy of our alliances with Japan, Korea, and the Philippines affecting our relationship with China. A hardening of our domestic politics, turning it into a North Korea or an Iran-type confrontation, would really limit our ability to work with China on other issues outside of the South China Sea. China is going to be a major player in the 21st century, and we really need to retain some sort of collaborative relationship with other issues that will come up in 20 years.
Well, British journalist Bill Hayton says the onus is on China to moderate its behavior. Hayton, who researches Asian affairs at London's Chatham House Institute, told VOA that he thinks Beijing is facing growing international pressure to abide by an upcoming ruling from a tribunal in The Hague. That tribunal is deciding on a Philippine complaint about Chinese actions in the South China Sea.
There are now so many people in so many countries signing up saying this ruling should be respected. We've just had the G7 doing it. We've just had the ASEAN foreign ministers, you know, endorsing the idea of legal moves. That it looks as if, you know, this is a major push from everybody to try to get China to respect these rules. I mean, if China could bring itself to say, you know, we accept UNCLOS as the basis for regulating the South China Sea, then in effect they remove the entire points of conflict with the United States in the region.
Well, China already is a signatory to UNCLOS, or the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea. But Beijing has rejected the involvement of the Hague Tribunal in the South China Sea dispute, saying the issue should be resolved only through one-on-one negotiations with China's smaller neighbors. Turning to the U.S. presidential race, state primary contests for Republican and Democratic contenders conclude this coming Tuesday. Businessman Donald Trump has already secured enough delegates from previous contests to become the Republican Party's presumptive presidential nominee. But Democratic frontrunner and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton still faces a challenge from her only rival, Senator Bernie Sanders. Polls show that both are running neck and neck in California. I spoke earlier to VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman and asked him why the West Coast state is so important to Clinton and Sanders.
California is the biggest state in the country, and it is the biggest delegate prize, therefore, in the country. And it simply looks bad if Democrat Hillary Clinton, the front runner, someone who everyone knew was going to be in the race years ago, if this individual who has been on the national stage for so long limps towards the convention with a series of losses in states. The argument that the Sanders camp makes is that if they win all these states towards the end of the primary season, that it gives them momentum. Now, for anyone who has given a serious look to the actual delegate math, I think a reasonable conclusion would be that the idea of momentum is somewhat skewed, that what actually matters are hard figures. And looking at the delegate math, it does not look good for Bernie Sanders, even if he were to eke out wins in states like California and New Jersey, which are voting on Tuesday.
But Sanders says that he thinks he can persuade some of those superdelegates that are currently supporting Hillary to go to his side, and that could create the conditions for a contested convention. You know, how likely is that scenario?
Well, based on history, it's not very likely at all. You only have to go back to 2008 when, interestingly enough, it was the Hillary Clinton camp that was making the argument that even though she was trailing then-Senator Barack Obama in the pledge delegate count, that she could come out on top at the convention thanks to the superdelegates. It didn't work out that way. That's not to say that it's impossible, but the idea when Hillary Clinton today in 2016 is leading in pledge delegates, is leading in the popular vote over Bernie Sanders by several million, the idea that the superdelegates are going to overrule the popular will seems to me at least to be somewhat far-fetched.
Well, on the Republican side, while Trump doesn't face any other challenges from his party, he is facing scrutiny from members of his party about some of his recent comments about race. I asked Bowman why those comments are being criticized.
There have been a series of high-profile Republicans in Congress and around the country who have come around to the view that, well, okay, Donald Trump is the nominee, he may be a flawed candidate, but he's better than Hillary Clinton. That seems to be the emerging Republican talking point, that whatever differences and dislikes we have concerning Donald Trump, they pale in a comparison to the differences with Hillary Clinton. Nevertheless, Donald Trump does not seem to be able to resist his ability or his demonstrated proclivity for saying things that caused the Republican establishment a huge amount of heartburn. Most recently, I believe that there was an African American in the crowd, and he called out that individual on the basis of that person's race. That certainly raised some eyebrows. There is a university bearing Donald Trump's name that is under federal investigation, and the judge in the case happens to be of Mexican descent. He was born in the United States, but is of Mexican descent. And Donald Trump said that he doubts the ability of that judge to be impartial based on his Mexican heritage.
Right, well, I think that's the comment from Trump that got the most scrutiny and criticism from fellow Republicans, right?
Indeed, indeed. And this follows, of course, Trump's statements that not only would the United States build a wall between the United States and Mexico, but that Mexico would pay for it. He's also called Mexicans rapists and murderers. And so this is the latest in a series of what are truly incendiary comments concerning heritage, race, and ethnicity.
I think Trump did get a little bit of support from the former U.S. Attorney General Gonzalez under the Bush administration. I believe he expressed some sympathy for Trump's case, but I guess you'll have a variety of views, as always. Thanks so much to our Senate correspondent, Michael Bowman, for giving us the latest word from the campaign trail.
Always a pleasure, Michael.
This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
January, astronomers from the California Institute of Technology got the scientific world buzzing when they revealed evidence of a big planet circling the sun in the outskirts of the solar system. The planet, nicknamed Planet Nine, has not been directly imaged yet. So far, findings related to its discovery are based on factors such as the gravitational behavior of a group of objects that are mostly orbiting beyond the Kuiper Belt. Astronomers at Sweden's Lund University say that it is highly likely that Planet Nine was actually snatched from another solar system by our young sun some 4.5 billion years ago. The researchers figured that since stars are formed in tight clusters, this would make it possible for one star to steal a planet or planets from another as they pass close to each other. The researchers claim Planet Nine would be the first exoplanet discovered in our solar system. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition with me, Michael Lippin. Well, American country music singer Blake Shelton has had a tumultuous year. Both his public divorce from fellow country artist Miranda Lambert and his new romance with pop star Gwen Stefani have overshadowed his recent accomplishments in film, television, and music. Shelton has remained relatively quiet about his private life, that is, until now. On his newly released album, If I'm Honest, Shelton shares his romantic highs and lows from the past year. Nikki Strong of VOA Music joins International Edition's Sarah Williams to tell us more.
So, Nikki, Blake said this album would be personal. Did he deliver, and was it what we were waiting for?
Yes, he delivers, I'm very happy to say. And he delivers on a couple of levels. So musically, I enjoyed the album. There's great cuts there, there's party jams, there's fun stuff, there's personal ballads. And he goes deeply personal. So he really takes us on a journey on where he was emotionally after his heartbreak and his divorce with Miranda into where he is now with Gwen Stefani. And when the story starts, it begins with a song that many of the tabloids are having a ball with because it's like an indictment of Miranda, and it's called She's Got Away With Words. Check out these lyrics. It's a cleverly written song, and it says, she put the her in hurt, she put the why in try, she put the SOB in sober, she put the hang in hangover, she put a big FU in my future. Yeah, she's got away with words. Ouch, ouch, ouch.
Wow.
Yeah. But you know, with divorce comes anger. So I mean, it's legit. And to be fair, you know, she may have a way with words, but in light of how clever the song is written and the way he sings it, I would say that Blake has a way with words too. So touche there, but it's a cleverly written song. And then we move on to two more breakup songs. So he really like gets the venom out of the way. Mm-hmm. And we move on to two more songs that are really more sentimental and very sweet, just like how he's been thinking about her. When you break up with somebody and how they're on your mind, how are they doing? I hear that song and I think of her. Then it moves into the song Came Here to Forget. And after you hear those two songs about how much he's remembering Miranda, it makes sense. You go, yeah, you need to, yeah, go somewhere to forget about it. And that song becomes part of the turning point because the song is about two friends connecting. You know, implied is him and Gwen Stefani over their recent heartbreak and endeavoring to move on as they drown in their sorrows. And from that, the album takes a turn and becomes lighter. And you start to really hear the story of two friends who then start really connecting and bonding and start developing romantic feelings towards each other. And you see that develop in the next several songs. It really makes sense. It's very honest. I like the fact that I don't think the album is petty. It's very good. And it's honest and it makes sense. And many are quoting the lyrics of these songs out of context, but you really need to listen to the songs in full and in the context of the album. And it tells you really what happens from his perspective. And it is good. And it is honest.
Did Blake write all the songs?
You know what? He didn't, especially the one She's Got Away With Words. He didn't write it.
Oh.
He didn't write it. But the music, it has really been well curated to capture his voice. And the music, I said, on the CD is really good, too. And it's not all about Miranda and Gwen, but a good chunk of it is. And Blake has a very clever sense of humor, and there are songs that capture that as well, like The Cut's Green and Doing It to Country Songs with the Oak Ridge Boys. So the first song is also really a really great banger. It's called Straight Outta Cold Beer. So the album itself is not a bunch of random radio hits, which, you know, a lot of artists do, but they're great songs individually, but they really provide an overarching experience of what he's been through for the year. It's thumbs up, Blake. He delivered.
It is number one on the country music charts now, yes?
Yeah. So it went to number one. Of course, people were buying it. They were curious, and people are really liking it. If I'm honest, the name of the CD, it's number one on the Billboard Country Albums chart. And the single, Came Here to Forget, shot up to the top as well.
You can hear music from Blake Shelton, Miranda Lambert, and more on Country Hits USA with Nikki Strong on VOA 1. You can reach Nikki on Twitter at @VOA_music and on Facebook at VOA Music. Thanks, Nikki.
You're always welcome.
Well, that's it for International Edition on the Voice of America. Your director today was Tracy Carter. The engineer was Daryl Smith. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Have a great week.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The State Department has designated the Tariq Jadar Group, or TGG, and Jamaat al-Dawa al-Quran, or JDQ, as specially designated global terrorists. This designation imposes sanctions on foreign entities determined to have committed or pose a significant risk of committing acts of terrorism that threaten the security of Americans or the United States. As a result of these designations, all property under U.S. jurisdiction in which the TGG or JDQ have any interest is blocked, and American citizens are generally prohibited from engaging in any transactions with the TGG or JDQ. The TGG is a Pakistani Taliban-linked group based in Dara al-Damkel, Pakistan. The TGG is responsible for multiple large-scale fatal attacks, including the December 2014 massacre at the Army Public School in Peshawar, Pakistan, that left 132 schoolchildren and 9 staffers dead, the deadliest terrorist attack in Pakistan's history. TGG's leader, Umar Mansour, is also known as the mastermind of the January 2016 attack on Bacha Khan University in Charsadah, Pakistan, that killed 20 and wounded between 50 and 60 others. In addition to these devastating attacks, the TGG is responsible for the 2010 kidnapping of a British journalist traveling to North Waziristan, Pakistan, and the 2008 kidnapping and beheading of Polish geologist Piotr Stanchak in Attock, Pakistan. JDQ is a terrorist group based in Peshawar, Pakistan, and eastern Afghanistan, which pledged allegiance in 2010 to now-deceased Taliban Emir Mullah Omar and has long-standing ties to Al-Qaeda and Lashkar-e-Taiba. JDQ has been responsible for various attacks, including the infamous 2010 kidnapping and death of British aid worker Linda Norgrove in Kunar Province, Afghanistan. the imposition of sanctions are a powerful tool against terrorists. With these actions, the U.S. is notifying the American public and the international community that TGG and JDQ are actively engaged in terrorism. Terrorism designations enable the government to coordinate actions to disrupt the activities of terrorists, including denying them access to the U.S. financial system and enabling U.S. law enforcement actions. The United States will continue to expose, isolate, and sanction those who commit acts of terrorism.
That was an editorial.